This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, contributor to Detroit Public Television's Great Lakes Bureau, Gary Wilson, discusses what the Trump administration's latest moves could mean for the Great Lakes. But first, a few weeks back, you may remember that we had a segment on the Michigan Campaign Finance Network's analysis of the most expensive state House races of 2016. Now there are numbers on spending at another stage of the process. The Campaign Finance Watchdog Group reports that 2016 set a new record for money spent on lobbying at the state capitol. Michigan Campaign Finance Network Director Craig Mauger joins us from Lansing. Thank you for being with us, Craig.
Thanks for having me.
The headline on your report at your website, 2016, the Year of the Lobbyist in Michigan. What made 2016 the Year of the Lobbyist?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons that we chose to go with that headline, and we talked about it quite a bit, and we also came to the realization that 2017 could be another year of the lobbyist as well if the trends keep going the way that they're going. But what made 2016 fit this headline is that we saw more money spent by Michigan lobbyists than any year before, and we saw some subject matters taken up in the legislature that were really fertile ground for lobbyists to work on. I mean, really expansive issues. The article that we posted focused on the energy reforms that happened when you saw more than 100 lobbyists chime in on the bills. So there was just a very active Lansing lobbying culture this year.
Now, the energy bill is an interesting one because it's very complex. There's a lot of different players that have an interest in that bill. So is it possible that the energy bill made 2016 an outlier some way in terms of the money spent on lobbying?
I think it's, you know, because of our extremely lax transparency laws, it's impossible to tell for sure. But I think it's very possible that the energy bills helped drive these numbers up, because there are so many different business groups and labor groups interested in what happens with those bills, that maybe that put a little bit more money into lobbying. However, at the same time, our lobbying numbers have been trending upward year over year, basically, since 2012. 2012, we had a pretty high year at $37 million, but 2013, 2014, 2015, and 2016, it's gone up every year, and now we're at about $40 million. For your listeners, about $40 million was reported on lobbying spending in Michigan in 2016. If we go back to 2010, it was only $31.8 million. So that's almost a 25% increase.
You say that it's possible that the energy bills drove this spending by lobbyists up a little more than we might expect. But how difficult is it to actually quantify that based on what is reported and what the public and groups like yours have the opportunity to analyze?
It's basically impossible to quantify that. I mean, you can look at a handful of groups that you know are very interested in what happens with proposals like energy. You know, on energy, you know the utilities are big players in that. You know that some of the generation companies are big players in that. So you can look at their numbers and get an idea, but you can't really get the whole picture because, unlike many other states, many other states, the lobbyists in Lansing don't have to disclose any information about what bills they're working on, what government actions they're trying to influence. The Sunlight Foundation has put out information previously that 30 states require their lobbyists to disclose that type of information. In Michigan, we don't have that, so it's impossible to know exactly what they're working on. Our kind of idea that the energy bills played a large role in this was from talking to lawmakers who are the subjects of the lobbying, and I think multiple lawmakers have told me that they received more lobbying attention on those bills than anything else they've seen in their career.
You also find that a lot of the money being spent by lobbyists are by these multi-client firms. So they represent a lot of different interests. And one can assume that part of the reason that they get hired is that they're effective at their jobs. But it's perhaps a side benefit of that from the lawmakers and the lobbyist standpoint that it makes it that much harder to know exactly where the money is being spent on which particular issues.
Yeah, I mean, I think that might be a factor for some groups, but I mean, I think the multi-client firms get a lot of business because they are effective. And meanwhile, like you're noting, it's impossible really to track what they're doing. If you look through minutes of committee meetings, you hardly ever see a lobbyist from a multi-client firm show up in the minutes of having submitted testimony. However, they're always in the room. They're always working lawmakers, and they're extremely active, and the numbers bear that out. I think about the top nine lobbying groups in 2016 were all multi-client firms.
And they only have to report spending twice a year, correct?
Yeah, that's something that I think surprises a lot of people. You know, we have a full-time legislature that's here all year round, unlike a lot of states. We have a very active lobbying core in Michigan, you know, $40 million. And these guys only have to file disclosures about what they're doing twice a year. And I think the most striking thing about this is If a lobbyist pays for a trip in January, that doesn't show up on the public disclosures until August, the end of August. So there's a 7-month delay. Another kind of example of this, you know, if a lobbyist pays for, you know, thousands of dollars worth of meals for a couple of lawmakers in August before an election, the public doesn't get to know about that until January, long after the election has already taken place. So there's a real lack of disclosure. I mean, twice a year, to require reporting twice a year for an industry that's spending $40 million is pretty strange.
We'll get to meals spent on lawmakers in just a moment, but you talked earlier about other states having more strict requirements on lobbyists having to disclose what they are lobbying for. Do other states also have more reporting? In other words, that lobbyists have to report more often how much money they're spending?
Yeah, some states have reporting requirements that try to be real time. You know, they try to get the reporting to happen as close to the expenditure as possible. A lot of states have taken huge steps to try to bring transparency to this realm, and we were posting on Twitter about our numbers just the other day, and a Kentucky Ethics Commission responded saying that in Kentucky, lawmakers aren't even allowed to accept meals from lobbyists. So, I mean, Michigan's laws are really different from most other states, as they are in so many areas of transparency, and different in a bad way, I should say.
So you say that the lobbyists may not show up and submit testimony in committee hearings, but they are certainly meeting with lawmakers, and oftentimes it appears that in the course of that, someone is being bought dinner. What were you able to tell from these numbers?
Yeah, so we looked at a part of the reporting the lobbyists do have to make is if they buy a certain amount of meals for a lawmaker in a year, they have to disclose it, or in a month. So we looked at all the food purchases that happen, and we found that 25 different state lawmakers received more than $1,000 in free meals each last year alone. Lobbyists in total reported spending $690,000 on what they described as food expenses for public officials. However, it's almost impossible to track the majority of that spending. We tracked, I think, about $200,000 of it, of where it ended up through the reports.
And why is it so hard to track that?
It's so hard to track it, again, because of our reporting requirements. I mean, I keep coming back to this, but it's the reality that people have to understand. In Michigan, if a lobbyist doesn't spend more than $58 on meals for a lawmaker in a month, they don't have to report that they had a meeting with that lawmaker, that they bought that lawmaker anything. So $58 in a month is a pretty high threshold, considering I think a bone-in filet at the most expensive restaurant in downtown Lansing costs $39, according to their menu that we looked up. So someone could be buying a filet at that restaurant, Tropo, in downtown Lansing, once a month for 10 months in a row, and that would never show up in the reporting because it's under the threshold. I think the threshold is also $350 for a year in terms of what lobbyists can buy without disclosing it. Those are pretty high thresholds, and just by having a threshold, it provides an opportunity for lobbyists to find ways around disclosure.
Let me just play devil's advocate for a moment on this. You know, as you know, all of us in journalism are told that we have to be careful about what we accept. And it's generally advised if you meet a source for lunch or dinner that you don't let them buy your food. But I have to tell you, I've been in these situations where you get your wallet out and someone just insists that they're going to pay for lunch. And I've often come to the conclusion that it's not worth the argument and not worth the battle or the lecture over journalistic ethics. And frankly, if my integrity and my reporting can be bought for a club sandwich and a cup of soup, then I should probably be doing something else for a living anyway. Can't these lawmakers say that, look, you know, if someone's buying me dinner, it doesn't necessarily buy my vote?
How much is a club sandwich and a cup of soup in the situation that you're talking about? I mean, is that $12?
It's less than the bone-in filet that you mentioned. That's a fair point.
$20? I mean, you're talking about a lunch that costs, you know, at maximum $20. And you're talking about an occasional lunch. I mean, how many times does that happen in your journalism career?
Not often, in a year? Right.
Five times? That's $100. We have lawmakers that are ringing up meal tabs for a year of $4,000. So to compare $4,000 in free food to the ethics of taking a club sandwich, you know, it's just not a fair comparison. We have 25 lawmakers that received $1,000 in free meals from lobbyists, and that's just what the disclosures show. We looked up some data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that showed that the average American household spent $3,000 on food away from home in the entirety of 2015. We have lawmakers that are getting more free meals from lobbyists than that amount. I mean, this is not just a small, you know, I'm having a lunch with the constituent and the constituent offered to pay for the meal. This is a widespread thing that's happening, and it's not just anybody paying for the meals. These are people who are getting paid to influence public policy who are paying for the meals. So they're not just meeting with these lawmakers because they like the lawmaker in most situations. They're meeting with them to try to influence what they're doing. Number one, if we're going to have a system that allows for this, there needs to be disclosure around it so the public can judge all of the actions that lawmakers are taking, all of the meals they're having. And I think number two, we've really got to have a conversation about whether this level of spending, $4,000 on meals, is good for democracy in our state.
Do these numbers, both on the amount of money spent on lobbying as well as what is being spent to, shall we say, wine and dine lawmakers, maybe show here what the price of admission is for trying to have influence in Lansing when it comes to legislation that lawmakers are considering from, you know, day to day, month to month, et cetera?
I think for me, that's the most troubling part of this, is that as the cost of lobbying goes up and up, I mean, the amount of money being spent on lobbying goes up and up, the amount of money pouring into our campaign finance system goes up and up and up, the ability for the average person to influence public policy is going down. I mean, if you're not spending money on lobbying when someone else is, you know, spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on lobbying, what chances do you have? And if you talk to lawmakers, they'll admit that lobbying is really having a huge influence. I mean, that's an understatement. There was a lawmaker that we quoted in one of the articles we put out on this in the last 2 weeks who said, when he has some groups come to him asking him to do something on public policy or asking for some type of change, that he's flat out told them, you might want to hire a lobbyist if you really want to get something done. So, I mean, to go from from this ideal that the public should be able to take concerns to their representative and hope that the representative acts on them or that those concerns are at least heard and influences them, to this place where, you know, we're actively telling people, if you want something done, you might want to consider hiring a lobbyist. That's a huge bar to get over to try to influence public policy.
And do your numbers also show that that simple idea of hiring a lobbyist may not really get the job done? In other words, that you get what you pay for. You know, the multi-client firms, I'm sure, don't do this on the cheap. In other words, you may hire a lobbyist, but at the same time, that lobbyist may not be able to be as effective as the ones in Lansing who have been doing this for a long time, unless, of course, you're willing to pony up some pretty big bucks to pay for that.
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. I mean, if you talk to people from the multi-client firms, they'll tell you, you know, if you really want to have success, you need to hire a multi-client firm. So it's hard to tell. I mean, it's most likely that's just their, you know, advertising technique, you know, marketing technique. But because of the laws, it's impossible to tell exactly how much lobbying spending is affecting legislative outcomes, because in general, we don't know how much is being spent on each side of pieces of legislation. And that should cause people to think about this as well, because we might have a huge problem where the side that spends the most on lobbying is winning issue after issue, but it's impossible to tell.
Craig Mauger, as always, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Michigan Campaign Finance Network Director Craig Mauger joined us from Lansing. Links to the network's reports on money spent on lobbying and on meals bought for state lawmakers can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. After the November election, we spoke with Gary Wilson about what the Trump administration could mean for Great Lakes policy. Now, nearly 2 months after President Trump took office, we have a better idea, including a proposed cut to federal Great Lakes restoration funding. We again turn to Gary Wilson, who is now a contributor to Detroit Public Television's Great Lakes Bureau. Gary Wilson, once again, thank you for being with us.
Hey, Gordon. Been a while. Good to be back with you.
So if this proposed cut were to stand the Great Lakes restoration programs, what would that mean in terms of the impact it would have on programs for the region?
Well, if the cuts stand, Gordon, it would be absolutely devastating for the programs. When you take something that's been in place, fully implemented beginning in 2010, and take it from $300 million a year to $10 million a year, you know, it's the rough equivalent of just doing a panic stop if you're driving your car. There are so many programs in place, and so many of them are going forward. And then when you suddenly pull the funding from them, and not only the funding, you're threatening to cut the staff at the EPA who implements many of the programs, most of them, by 20-25%, pick your number. And that just puts a halt to everything. There's no slowdown. There's no wind-down period. It would have a serious impact all across the basin from New York to Minnesota.
If we look back at President Trump, now President Trump, when he was campaigning last year, would we say that these cuts match what he was talking about on the campaign trail? Do these cuts match his rhetoric?
Well, you know, he's such a wild card with what he says. You know, he's very bombastic, as we all know, and he says one thing one day and, you know, kind of goes in a different direction the next day, depending on, you know, who he's speaking to. He's always been after the EPA, not singling out Great Lakes programs or any specific watershed, but he's been after the EPA for a couple of years. Now, that said, he did send a surrogate to the Great Lakes Conference that took place in Sandusky, Ohio, last September, and the gentleman presented to the mostly environmental groups, and he just said that the Great Lakes were on Mr. Trump's radar, and how much he cared about clean water. And Eric Trump, President Trump's son, had Trump's ear about environmental issues, and he pledged, you know, continued support for the Great Lakes. He did not mention any dollar amounts, though. So that seemed to placate the activists a little bit. And I'm not sure that they were ready for this shoe that fell last week on the budget.
Has Great Lakes funding been a partisan issue in the past, or has it broken down more along geographic lines, you know, the congressional representatives of Great Lakes states being on board regardless of party?
Great Lakes states, on funding, the Great Lakes congressional delegation has been in sync, be they Republicans or Democrats. And as far as nationally, you know, most regions of the country have programs similar to the Great Lakes Restoration programs. Chesapeake Bay has one, San Francisco Bay, Puget Sound, the Everglades. So, and they're all looking for federal money to support the program. So there's been a level of comity, spelled ITY, in Congress about funding these programs for the last 8 years, be they for Republicans or Democrats. So a short answer is good bipartisan support up until this point.
And in this case, we are talking about, in terms of Great Lakes states, a number of Republican members of Congress who it would seem have some influence, not the least of which would be Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House from Wisconsin. But you could also probably include Fred Upton in there from Southwest Michigan, who is no longer chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, but is a veteran congressman who is known for working across the aisle, getting things done. Would it be fair to say that this could run into some headwinds from the Republicans in Congress who hold some powerful positions in these Great Lakes states?
I think the Republicans generally will be on board in trying to restore some of this money. I wouldn't rely too much on Paul Ryan. His district is has Lake Michigan front in it. But he's always been fairly aloof when it comes to Great Lakes issues, which is fairly curious. He's not against them, but he doesn't lobby and work hard for them. But Fred Upton could be a key player. Representative David Joyce from the Cleveland area has been an advocate. He's a Republican. He's been an advocate for restoring the Great Lakes, for securing money. I think you're going to see some pushback by the Great Lakes congressional delegation. But when it gets right down into trench warfare, how hard will they push? How much will they be able to restore? You know, that's why they call these processes sausage making. They're not pretty to watch, and it'll be interesting to see what comes out the other end.
Also should have mentioned Bill Heisinger there, the congressman from Zeeland, who is head of this Great Lakes Congressional Working Group right now as well. Realistically, if we're looking ahead politically here, what are some likely outcomes? I mean, it may be hard to pinpoint one likely outcome, but what are a couple things that might happen by the time the Trump White House and Congress sit down, mark up bills, and eventually reach some sort of agreement?
Well, I've been canvassing the region by talking with people who were in the Obama administration in positions of responsibility, kind of getting their feel for it. And the easy place to go is that they'll restore the money to $150 million, which is 50% of the 300, and all sides can declare victory. The Trump administration can say, well, we whacked the EPA's budget because that sells politically. And the Great Lakes states can say, hey, we fought the good fight and we took on the president and we got $150 million. And, you know, that was as good as could be done. A lot of those common rules are, you know, maybe off the table. This is not a president who plays by the standard rules that we've all come to accept on some level. So I gave up predicting a long time ago when it comes to Mr. Trump.
We're talking here mainly about policy, of course, but if we take a moment and look at this politically, the states that are going to be seriously affected include Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Those are states that former President Obama, won twice, states that now President Trump won in 2016, and if he had not won those three states, he wouldn't be the president of the United States right now. It's hard to know how politics plays into this always, but it certainly does. And does that provide a bit of a backdrop?
I think it does. And I just found it fairly astonishing, Gordon. You're right. If Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin don't go to the Trump camp, he's not president. And I would have thought that, you know, he would have taken a look at that, especially in Ohio, which has historically been sort of the ultimate swing state, and with Lake Erie, which borders on Michigan too, being the most vulnerable of the Great Lakes, and then to come through with an axe instead of a scalpel. When you're going to address the EPA budget or the Great Lakes restoration budget, again, there's no logic there, and that's what has people absolutely baffled.
So, explain a little bit about something called the Waters of the United States Rule.
The Waters of the United States Rule, Gordon, is a rule promulgated by the Obama administration. And what it's meant to do is to clear up exactly what waters come under the Clean Water Act. You know, the Clean Water Act is the federal law in place since the early 70s that governs the states, you know, which waters can be regulated by the federal government. And it goes like this, and that is you've got creeks that lead to streams that lead to rivers that lead to lakes. So if you don't pay attention to what comes out of those creeks, streams, and rivers, you know, you're not going to control what goes into the lakes. And there were two Supreme Court decisions in the past 5 or 6 years that really, instead of clearing things up, they really just muddied the waters. Sorry for the bad pun there. So the Obama administration took it on and charged the U.S. EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers with sorting this out. And they went through a two-year process of crafting the rule, listening to various constituencies, and they finally finalized it and tried to implement it in 2015. Well, it was immediately challenged in court. The agricultural community and real estate developers were the two prime groups to take it on. Many attorneys general from the states also fought against it, and I believe Michigan's Attorney General Schuette has weighed in against the rule. So one of the first things that President Trump did was he can't roll back the rule. He doesn't have that authority, but he's going to have the EPA and the Army Corps review it. So it's on hold. It's on hold right now because it's in the courts and it's being appealed. But he definitely wants to get rid of it. And this is a landmark piece of, it's not legislation, a rule. So it's very important to not only the region, but the country.
There's also the delay in the plan, which was kind of the first step in trying to keep Asian carp out of the Great Lakes. But the Trump administration has put a delay in there as well. How time sensitive is that issue, Asian carp and just invasive species in general?
Well, they've been, you know, it's always time sensitive. You know, things move slowly, and, you know, but they have to move forward if someday you don't want to see, you know, you don't want to keep Asian carp from coming up the Kalamazoo River. The Army Corps was charged with putting together a plan to look at this area in the Chicago waterway system called the Brandon Road Lock. It is thought that this could be a choke point to keep the carp from advancing. There's good bipartisan support in general for this to look at this. And the Army Corps had gone through the process and done a study to present options. They weren't trying to implement anything. They were just trying to present the options. And they were ready to do so. And then literally on the last day, the Trump administration ordered the Corps to hold off. And they did that because they were getting a lot of pressure from the Illinois congressional delegation, along with Indiana, who are really wary of any infrastructure projects that could disrupt shipping. So many Republican representatives in the Illinois congressional delegation wrote to the president, asked him to put this study on hold, and he did.
Is this a rare case where we have an issue where the Great Lakes region on a Great Lakes issue is kind of divided? In other words, you just mentioned Illinois and Indiana there. Are they viewing Asian carp a little differently than perhaps it is viewed here in Michigan?
They definitely are, Gordon. You've got the other six Great Lakes states and Canada, Ontario and Quebec, aligned essentially against Illinois and Indiana. And that's because the shipping lobby is very powerful in Illinois and Indiana. There's a lot of barge traffic that moves through the Chicago waterway system, especially to northwest Indiana, carrying raw materials for production. And they have that economic argument on their side. And they're very well entrenched, and they're very skilled at lobbying the politicians.
Gary Wilson, as always, thank you for your time.
Good to be with you, Gordon. Thank you.
Gary Wilson is a contributor to Detroit Public Television's Great Lakes Bureau. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.